Hey everybody, welcome to Lecture 36. This is our penultimate lecture together. We're going to have a lecture together on Monday, and then Wednesday we'll actually close it out. You'll have one final lecture on Friday by Scott, but that's the last lecture I'll be giving. On any lecture on performance, this is a new topic. Any lecture on performance, you need to talk about what the fastest computer is, and they have a competition every 6 months for the fastest supercomputer. And the way they measure that is they have them run something called the LINPACK floating point benchmark. We're going to talk about that today. It tries to solve the expressions AX equals B for really, really large matrices. And you try to figure out how many floating point operations it does a second. Floating point operations a second is a FLOP. F-L-O-P-S. So they're now a single box. I mean, it's a massive room of these things that essentially has one power cord and one input, can generate 2.3 petaflops. Wow. That is unbelievable. Let's think again. All right. Kila. What's next? Mega. Okay, so about a million. Giga. A billion. Tera. A trillion. Peta, I think it's quadrillion, I guess, right? Isn't that ridiculous? 2.3 quadrillion floating point operations a second. Unbelievable what that thing can do. It was a big deal when you could do a teraflop. It was a big deal when you first do a, you know, a petaflop, and now they do 2.3 petaflops, and it's ridiculous what they're doing. Anyway, this is a set of Linux machines. If you count the number of cores they have almost a quarter of a million cores. All working at once, all working. This is obviously a very massively parallel problem when they have them do this benchmark. So you have very little loss of overhead. Pretty impressive stuff. So why do we think about performance? This is a whole new topic. Last time I gave you three lectures in one, and this is now we're back to the pace of one lecture from previous years to one lecture today. So we're talking about performance, and you ask myself, why do we ever care about speed? Well, obviously, if you're a gamer, you care about speed. But for the most part, you know, word is word, and who cares if the machine you have runs 100 times faster, you're still just doing text editing. That's a very realistic comment and a very reasonable comment. But the reality is many things are bottlenecked by speed. If you want to do a compile on a really big piece of software, you're waiting for that. If you want to try to solve chess for some end game database, you're waiting for that. There are lots of things you want to do. Some lexical translation, you're waiting for that. Those are things that really could benefit by more CPU power. So from the point of view of purchasing, if you have a need for more power, you want to do a render, you want to do a Photoshop blur, there's a lot of things that actually are CPU bound. We call that CPU bound. The CPU is the bottleneck. So from a purchasing perspective, you actually care about, given all the possible configurations you can buy, from small netbook to top-of-the-line workstation class stuff, what is the best performance? Without a question about cost. Which is the least cost without a question of performance? And which is perhaps the best balance of those performance per cost? From a computer design point of view, you want to build a system. You now work for Dell or Acer or Apple, and you have the choice of lots of components to put together and put a label on it with your fancy company logo, and hopefully you get some profits from that. What do you optimize for? Or do you try to somehow sweep through and cover all of the range from the highest end to the lowest end? But maybe something in the middle, where do you make a decision of where do you stop and where do you stop, you know, putting more money in for the performance? What kind of sub pieces give you the best bang for the buck? So the key thing of this slide is that one of the nice things that we've learned in the computing engineering field is that solid metrics lead to solid progress. And what that means is, this is a really important line, I'll say it again. Solid metrics lead to solid progress. One of the arguments for why one particular interface, human-computer interface, is better than the other, why there's still discussion over Emacs versus VI, or whether Mac versus PC in terms of the OS, is there's no solid metric. If there were a solid metric, can you, for example, in the OS, have the user copy 100 files and rename some directories and go find a lost file and recover things and go to the web. If there were a way, like a really clear metric that said this is the best way to measure that interface, we could have a real discussion of which is better based on that metric. If you don't have that, then you're still talking about VI versus Emacs till the cows come home because you have no metric. So part of the benefits of thinking about this. By the way, this is a multi-billion dollar industry, right? Making sure you have the fastest machine, and that can determine what people buy. If they're buying a gaming machine and you have the fastest there, you're going to make a lot of money. So you really need to understand what are you optimizing for in terms of performance. So let's take a look at what performance means in different contexts. I'm going to take a flight to Qatar a week from now. That was really bad. I'm sorry about that. Visit our friend feedback. Let me turn this down a little bit. What if I wanted to have two options of where to take this flight? Let me turn this down just a hair and see if I can not walk up that aisle and try this one. Can you still hear me in the back? Is that okay? I don't want to yell. Nods, thank you. So I'm taking a flight. I have two options. I can take this Boeing 747 or the Concorde. The Concorde doesn't run anymore, but this slide, you know, persists beyond the Concorde. The Concorde was a great plane at the time. It was one of the fastest ever built. So let's talk about that. D.C. to Paris. This really should be Berkeley to Qatar, but for now it's D.C. to Paris. Top speed was 610 miles an hour, pretty fast. Look at the Concorde, 1350. That is ridiculous how fast that Concorde used to be. Number of passengers is obviously bigger than the Boeing. The Concorde was really for executives who need to be able to get from New York to London. That was the whole idea, New York to London in a couple hours. So if you had the money, you could do it. Here's what's interesting. Here's throughput. Passenger miles per hour. Let's say you had to evacuate D.C. and move them all to Paris. How fast could you evacuate D.C.? Well, this person miles per hour may factor in as a more important factor than the total trip time or the top speed. This may be the number you look at. So you say, which has higher performance? If you're delivering 100 passengers, well, both of these planes can handle 100 passengers with one trip. So if I only need 100 passengers ever, which is better? Concorde, without even blinking, right? How about as many passengers per day as possible in terms of evacuating DC? Well, maybe the throughput in person miles an hour is the right thing. So in the computer, we have two ideas. One is called the execution time, right? That's just the total time it takes to do something. And one is called the throughput or bandwidth. How much stuff can you get done in one, what's your rate in some sense? It's your rate of progress for that. So performance is clear that bigger is better. Faster is always better in performance. So how do we look at that? Well, there's execution time we talked about before. Execution time is what we're mostly going to be looking at here. So execution time is some number of units in seconds. Performance, then, from this graph, you can tell from your high school just unit calculation, performance is inverted seconds. It's 1/seconds. That's how you measure performance. Okay? And so when you say something is faster than the other, it's just a ratio of the performance, which is either the time of the slow guy over the time of the fast guy. If something takes 10 seconds, something takes 2 seconds, but one thing is 5 times faster, or the performance, which is 1/2 versus 1/10, and so that's still a factor of 5 here, right? So let's look at the time of the Boeing. 6.5 hours over 3 hours. Remember, you're dividing the time. When you do time, just divide the bigger over the smaller. So the bigger guy over the smaller, 2.2 times faster. Okay, so I can say, boy, I now have this metric. Solid metrics leads to solid progress. If I only care about this time issue, then it's only about how fast I can get from A to B. How fast can I do the transporter level connection from DC to Paris? So 222 times faster. We don't want to say percentage. We're going to say that in a slide or two. We don't want to say percentage because it's a little more complicated. We say a multiplying factor. So 2.2 times is universally understood as 2.2 times faster. It's the ratio of the slower of the faster. In terms of the throughput, well, divide 286,000 by 178,000, you get 1.6 times faster. Okay? So we're going to care about response time for the most part. We're going to say, you have a job to get done. What is it there? What is that overall time, not the throughput? So as I said, we're going to stick to this times faster, because when you factor in the percentage, see this 60% faster? You got to factor in the 1 to make it 160%. To make it 1.6 times is more complicated than just saying 1.6 times. That just tells you a ratio, and that's much easier than thinking this percentage-y things. Humans get confused by the percentage. We're going to stay with the X factor, right? So it's 1.6 times factor. From now on, from this moment till the end of 621C, which is the end of your last dot on the final exam, we only ever ask you for the times faster, never the percentage. So if you say percentage, it's actually going to be marked with something wrong. I mean, you might actually write 160%, but we'll ding you a little bit for not saying 1.6. So please do always use the 2.2, 1.6 times faster. Okay. There are two ways of looking at time. A, you say, go. You say, run my large computational program, and you say, go. And you look at your stopwatch, and when it's all done, you say, stop, and you actually ask what that value is. That's called the response time or the elapsed time. But that's not so good. Why isn't that so good? Yes. Depends on it's, well, certainly has been having to do, but why would it vary? Why would the same thing maybe perhaps vary? Sharmista, give me. Yeah, I'm running other things at the same time. So, oh, okay, well, when you ran it during the day, obviously other people, 621C, are writing, compiling their last big thing. It's going to be slower than if you run in the middle of the night. And so to kind of equalize that, we typically look at the second thing, which is how much time did the CPU give to your program? And so remember we talked about the fact that the CPU is sharing its time among many programs that are running and rotating its attention, just like if you had many kids, you rotate attention to kind of give your love to each of the kids in some rotating scheme. You're obviously giving your love all the time, or giving your attention, I should say. You always give your love to your kids, but your attention is being shared. So CPU time is more accurate. It's how much time that CPU is giving to you, and that is now independent of the load on that machine. That makes sense? That's why we love CPU time, because now I run on a heavily loaded machine, I get the same rating as the next time I ran it, because I don't care. It's independent of other things on the machine. That's good stuff. That's really good. Okay? So I love that. So real time is the elapsed time, and the CPU is what we care about. Okay? So let's start talking about how to actually calculate the CPU time. Well, we know about, from a rating from the manufacturer, what our clock period is. You get this crystal, and the crystal says this machine, and it might be an overclocked thing that you went to Fry's and try to game my machine and get a, what's it called? You juice it? No, what's the phrase? Up-chip it, up-clock it, over-clock it, over. Yeah, you're messing with, you know, shaky things. So we talked to before about why that could be a problem, right? When you have this critical path, that's, you might not be able to write to the last register, and you might be violating the setup time. We talked about exactly why that is. When you try to overclock something, it's bad. Nevertheless, you've got a clock measured in clock cycles. You have a clock period. You know all this stuff. The clock rate is in hertz, or usually a very high frequency of hertz, so gigahertz is a very reasonable thing. And you have a clock period, which is inverse of that, which is measured as a function of seconds, or some small amount of seconds, like 1 nanosecond or half a nanosecond for a 2 gigahertz machine. We use this for the clock rate or the clock period. So here's the CPU execution. Now, this is at this point, put on your units hat. Remember in physics, you always want to make sure your units check at the end of the day. You are doing this now times 100. So put on that hat, put on your physics units hat as we approach the next few slides. I am measuring CPU execution time of a program. So what's the unit of that? Seconds per program. Okay, so stay with that. S over P. We want seconds per program. How long did it take from the CPU's point, not from the user's point of view, but from the CPU time per program? So, let's think about it. Clock cycles for a program, okay, is multiplied by the clock period. Okay, remember, I still want seconds per program. Okay, so I have clock cycles per program. How many clock cycles did it take? How many of these wavy things did it take? That's independent of how long each of those wavy things is, right? So it is clock CPU execution time per program, seconds per program, is somehow a function of this clock guy times maybe some function of how wide those things are. So let's think about it. Cycles per program is the total number of clock cycles per program times the seconds per cycle. And when I do this, the cycles cancel and I get seconds per program. Are we okay with that? You could also look at it this way. You could do clock cycles over clock rate. And because when you clock rate, the thing inverts, and it all just works out to be seconds per program. Okay? Just very easy so far. We're not doing something. This is just a product. I'm not doing any calculus today. This is simple algebra, something you probably learned in fifth grade. Okay. So, how do we define clock cycles? All right, let's take a step back. Well, we introduce this other piece here, which is clock cycles for a program. I want to know how many of these up and down guys are for a program. By thinking about that, I then forget how fast my clock is. It's only about how many up and down guys to get my program finished. That's all I'm thinking about. Clock cycles per program. I've lost time now, right? There's no seconds anymore. Look, show me seconds. No seconds. I feel like Family Feud. Show me seconds. No seconds. All right. So here's how we figure out clock cycles for a program. Well, I have the number of instructions for a program. You have that, right? If you count all the instructions you ever do, that's the instructions for one program. So that's I over P. That's also called the instruction count. The number of MIPS instructions you ever hit from start to end before your program finishes. Instructions per program, or instruction count. Times the average clock cycles per instruction. That kind of makes sense? Think about it again. I have the number of instructions in this program. So if I'm trying to figure out how many wavy guys there are, I don't know how many wavy guys there are, but I do know how many instructions there were. And if I knew somehow how many cycles per instruction, if I take the product of that, what do I get? Instructions per program times cycles per instruction. Watch. The I's cancel, and what do I get? Cycles per program, what I wanted. So far? Okay. So, this is pretty cool. And why is CPI cool? Because watch this. I now have a way of comparing two machines that support the same instruction set architecture. I have two machines that say, I'm a MIPS machine. And another one says, I'm a MIPS machine. I say, which is faster? I don't know. Tell me about your clock cycles per instruction on average. And the more efficient one, the fewer clock cycles per instruction, the faster you're going to be. Right? That's pretty cool. So if you had one that had this really crazy cache and could handle, in general, maybe one clock cycle per instruction, you're not going to get below one, right? That's a general thing. But if you get down to one, holy moly, is that awesome. Now, you have things that are not in the cache, and you have different things. So in general, you're not going to get that, but that would be the goal, okay? So let's now think about this. We wanted, stepping back, execution time for a program in CPU time, not in user time. I want seconds per program, which equals clock cycles times clock cycle time. That was from two slides ago. Substituting for clock cycles, which is this guy here, that was one slide ago, it is instruction count times CPI. So therefore, CPU execution time for a program equals a product of three things. Instruction count, the number of MIPS guys you have to hit, CPI, how much each of those guys took per instruction in terms of cycles, times how much each cycle took. All of that together gives you seconds per program. It is a function of three things. This is a beautiful summary of this. CPU time, seconds per program, is a function of three factors. I've said this like now for the fourth time, but I'll keep going until it kind of sinks in. Instructions per program, or instruction count, cycles per instruction, or CPI, seconds per cycle, a function of the clock rate. All those three things gives you the beautiful thing we want, seconds per program. If you're missing any of those three, you're not going to do it. Someone says, oh, look, I got this great machine. How fast is it? And they say, oh, man, it's awesome. It's a 7 gigahertz machine. You go, yeah, nice, but that's only this column. You still need to tell me two more things. You need to tell me, one, how many cycles per instruction? How efficient is that machine? And you need to tell me, when you coded it up, let's say you code up in a really bad way that ends up having many more instructions for that particular program. Two people are trying to compare, two things. And one person coded up really efficiently. Very few instructions. One person went, pfft, really inefficiently, many instructions. And that person is going to lose because this number is going to be huge, instructions per program. Isn't that kind of cool? So this whole thing is talking about execution time of one program. If I throw the program out, then these two, the last two pieces are the things about a machine. This first guy is about a particular workload, instruction for a program. Okay? But it's kind of neat. This whole thing is execution time for this particular program on this particular machine is that's about the program and that's about the machine, the last two features. Aloni.
Seeing cycles per instruction or the average of the CPI.
Yeah? It is. That's exactly right. Instructions per cycles per instruction is a function of actually what happens. But you have to average it over all workloads. It might be that particular workload happens to use the fast guys or happens to use the slow guys, but on average, you have to figure out some average based on some massive sampling of all the workload you'd ever do. That's exactly right. If you had a piece of software that was doing nothing but memory I.O. thingies versus another program that's doing nothing but adds and subtracts with no memory references, that's certainly going to be a difference in performance. You have to kind of figure out, for all the things you ever do, what's the average for that? We'll get to that in a couple slides. Say that question, because that actually leads to the next couple slides. Do you have any more comments here? Kind of cool, right? So, how do you figure out those three pieces? I want to figure out and estimate my CPU time. So, how do I figure this out? And the cool thing, look at this. This is it's a product of three pieces. Just like in physics, I could say, I give you the guys on the right, and you give me the guy on the left. Or, what else do I do in physics to you? You're like, oh, you're so sneaky. You give me any three of these guys, and I can feel out the fourth guy, right? So, I could, in theory, measure my CPU time based on a program that I have. It's, you know, my computer reports CPU time. I could also count the number of instructions I have in that program and kind of count all the loops and kind of figure that out. I could also look up on my spec what this is and based on that particular program calculate the CPI, right? So you understand that these are four things. I throw one of them away and I can figure out the other guys, okay? So clock time is in the spec. It's the rightmost column. The instruction count, you can do either one thing. You can either count the actual instructions in the loop of a small program. You could have a simulator. Actually, it's kind of cool. Write a simulator for this guy and just count the actual instructions that ever get visited. Or there's actually a cool hardware counter in a special register that you can query in some particular piece of hardware, which is kind of cool. They thought about this. They said, you know, if you ever care about how many instructions I ever saw, you can just query that from us. It's kind of neat. CPU is, as I said before, they calculated as the reverse thing of this, right? It's execution time over clock cycle over instruction count. And there is a cool counter for that as well. So you can actually query that as well. So here's another way. Here's your first calculated CPI for each individual instruction. That makes sense. Add's going to take this much. Loads are going to take this much. Ands are that much. Then you calculate the frequency of each of those guys. And guess what? You do some kind of weighted sum based on how much it costs me and how often I do that thing, and there's my CPI, as you can imagine, right? So let's look at it. This is an example for a typical RISC processor. Here we go. I've got an ALU, a load, a store, and a branch. Let's just pretend it's a very minimal MIPS instruction set, four guys. All right. In general, I'm going to be doing these four things this often. Hopefully that adds to 100%, and it does. So most of the time I'm spending my time in ALU, a little bit of loads, not many stores, and quite a few branches. Here is my CPI. How much each of those things costs me on average? Well, one for ALUs, and that's nice because I use most of the time is spent there. That's kind of nice. Uh-oh, five clock cycles per instruction for a load. That's probably because you have to factor in, you know, cache misses and all that stuff, right? So, but nicely, I don't hit it that often. It's only 20% of my time do I have to pay that large penalty. Stores are three and branches are two. The product of those guys is simply the product of those guys here. Okay, so it is 50% times one is a half. You keep multiplying them across and I get these numbers. I add them all up and says, this is my product. That number is my CPI. Right? That's my 2.2 CPI for that particular instruction mix That's my CPI. And here is, before I get to that question, here is where I spent my time. This is quite interesting. This is telling you what is costing you. All that wasted time is this guy right here. This is the most valuable piece of information for you to know how you should upgrade your machine. You go into Apple, go into any store, go into Best Buy, go into Fry's, and you say, I want to make my machine faster. If they push you, if they don't respond with a question, then they're not doing their job right. You say, I want to make my machine faster. They should say, have you run profiling and figure out where your machine is spending its time? Where is it spin waiting? Is it waiting because you're paging too much? Then buy more memory. Is it waiting at the CPU level because you got a lot of memory, got a lot of disk, but you are trying to do a big render and it's just not a fast CPU? Then let me take you to the CPU aisle. You see, if they don't respond with the question, they are not doing their job. They should ask you where you're spending your time. And you say, oh, slide 15 on Dan's lecture 36 is where I'm spending my time. And they say, well, what do you think? They would say, you took 61C. What do you think you should upgrade? And you say, I don't know. The start button? No. You upgrade the number of where you're spending time that's the biggest. That's where you try to optimize. If you optimize this guy, the branches. Let's optimize the branches. Let's pay a lot of money. Oh, man, it's bleeding edge prices. It's this custom new chip, handcrafted and flown in from another country, and here it is, and then, oh, with a gold encrusted thing, and you rip it open in 19 levels of packaging, and I now get a twice as fast brancher. Okay, my system, here's another computer, has branches twice as fast. Let's look at it. What is that doing for my branches? That says this CPI becomes a 1. Okay, twice as fast. Okay, so this 0.4, 0.2. So this went from 2.2 to 2.0. I doubled the speed of one of the pieces, and I saw a really small change. And that's because I'm not there all the time. So it's a function of where you, how often you're there, as well as how much you can increase. If you say, Dan, I can increase any one of these opponents by double, you pick the one that you spend the most time in. Well, you say, well, Dan, you can't get much less than 1. And I say, well, okay, you got me there. Let's say the CPI were bigger than 1 for all these guys. Well, then certainly I would go with the ALU guy, because I spend most of my time there. That's going to be the biggest win. Okay? Question, Wesley.
Are the CPIs always integers?
The CPIs are, if you kind of do an average, they don't have to be integers. I think we did the numbers here easily. This is kind of like, on average, what happens given some set of workload set. That's the idea, right? I mean, they shouldn't be integers, because if it's division of all those things, calculating CPI for each one might be some function of something else, so it's certainly not going to be an integer all the time, no. It's an average of what you get, right? All right.
Question.
Yes, question. Aloni, let's go back to this.
The best choice would be that half ALU
time? If the CPU could be reduced by a half.
Why would it be a better choice for half than both times?
Well, let's look at it. Actually, it might be a better. Let's look at it. Half a load time is going to factor in bigger. You're exactly right.
Changing the average.
You want to change the product by the most. It's changing the particular piece of that the most, I think. Right. You want to make 2.2 change the most. Right. That's right. 2.2 should get the lowest number. That's exactly right. Halving load is actually better. Partly because that number is so big. Because halving this guy only changes that factor by a half. And so this actually only goes to 0.25. That's only a change of 0.25. If you half the 5, it becomes 2.5. And so that becomes, you know, I half one of these guys go by half. So 0.5 goes to 0.25. That's not much change. I'm already pretty good with that. So you're exactly right. I'm sorry about that. Let me step back. Aloni caught me on that. You want to make this product the lowest number. Right? You want to make the weighted sum the lowest number. So it isn't just about this. It's about, yes, you spend most time there, but because it's a product of how often you spend the time times how much change it would be if you actually increased it by a lot. So it means that's the CPI. So the summary, let's go back. You want to make this 2.2 the smallest number you could. And so by having this that halves this number, that's point, I'll change it by 0.2. Having this guy would be changing by 0.15. Having this guy is only 0.25. And having the load is changing by 0.5. That's the most. So exactly right. Load is where you fix it. Exactly. Even though load isn't where you spend your time, but the CPI number dominates the most in terms of that product. Exactly right. You had a question, Iris? Okay. Ryan. Neil.
Kai.
Kai. He sits there at Kai. I'm so sorry. I got you right before. I blanked for a second. Exactly right. Yeah, it is where you spend the most time, which is here, right? In some sense, this maps to this directly, right? It's where you spend the most time, and it's clearly the load is where you spend the most time, so that's exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. Okay? So, how do you figure out what programs to use in your measurement? Okay? Well, you say, Dan, I'll just write a little loop. I'll write a little loop, and that'll be what I'll tell. I'll say, let me write a loop that says, I'll do an add and a sub and a load, and that's my loop. Good. Yeah, not so much. You want to have what's called a workload. You want to have a workload that represents, in a real sense, what you are really using your machine for. That's a workload. Okay? So, you know, if you're a graphic designer, you better have a workload that has to do with Photoshop and Illustrator and web design. If you are an engineer, you might want to spend your time in MATLAB crunching big matrices. If you are a computer graphics person like I am, you might spend your time in a renderer like Maya or like After Effects or something like that. Okay? So you might or may not also have access to a particular machine to do a benchmark before a purchase. You have a workload that you're going to use. I say, you know, you walk into Best Buy, I'm going to be using Photoshop for this. Show me the best machine that's fastest for Photoshop. You may or not have access to all the suite of machines to run your workload on to compare them. So it's nice if someone else would do that work for you. If someone else would come up with a beautiful suite of benchmarks, indicate all these really, like imagine a scatter shot that tries to sample all the space of work things that people would do with their computers and would show you the ratings in aggregate as well as for that particular thing. I particularly like game theory. That's what I do for my research. I'll talk about that in two lectures. So I want a machine that's fast for game theory kind of a things. Maybe a chess solver might be really, really good for me. So I want to be able to look up for the chess solving problems across the suite of machines that are out there, who's the fastest on solving this chessboard. So we have to change these benchmarks every 5 years. Does anybody know why we have to keep these benchmarks updated? Why do we have to care? Why can't I just have the benchmarks I used 40 years ago, and they, if they were good for them back, if they're good for my grandfather, it should be good for me? Yes. Exactly. What people do with computers changes drastically. And about every 5 years is about right. I don't know how many of you have visited YouTube recently, but that's what people do nowadays. They decompress video that's sent over the web. Things are sent over the web, and how those bits become a video picture is a new thing. If you have a camcorder, and you want to be able to compress that into different formats and ship that over. So what you're doing with video is critical now. It wasn't critical maybe 10 years ago. So what people use their computers for changes, as well as what other kind of gaming system would you have to kind of fight? If I say, this is the benchmarks for the millennium, 2000, year 2000, I come up with a suite of programs, I say, this is what it is. What might hardware people do, nefarious hardware people do, if they knew what the benchmarks were and we knew they weren't going to change? Question back. That's true. Benchmarks have different meanings in different times. That's true. I want to find out, how could a hardware person, Muhammad, game a system if I told you this is the benchmark and it's never changing for the next 40 years? Go.
You optimize your system for exactly those 10 programs. You don't care about anything else. To heck with any other program, but you're going to be the fastest guy in the world at that particular problem. That's exactly what happens. So we have to keep changing so that people can't just optimize for exactly that answer. Right? For example, if you know the problem is going to be search for the best chess move in this big thing, you could either go wonkity, wonkity, wonkity and do the right search, which is what you're supposed to do, or if you know that's the question, always answer A4 and just have it in your back pocket. Oh, I'll think for a while, A4, right? That's not fair. So you have to actually go through the process of actually doing the work and not trying to optimize for exactly that. Exactly right. So here's what we have. We have a consortium that is called SPEC. Who's heard of the SPEC benchmarks before? Raise your hand. Only a couple, maybe about 5%, 10%. The most recent benchmark came out in 2006. It's called CPU 2006. It comprises of 12 integer problems and 17 floating point problems. Why do we divide it like that? Why don't we just say the problems and maybe ignore one of those categories? Yeah. Exactly. So right there is 29 different applications. And all that means is that's 29 different categories, and we kind of summarize them. And it might be the case that a certain machine rock and rolls on the integer and is a really slow machine on the floating point, or vice versa, or who knows. But there are kind of different things. The floating point is for scientists, people who care about floating points, the problems, engineers. Integer is also for engineers and scientists, but a little less so. Usually more computer science-y, discrete math-y kind of things for integer problems, like solving a chessboard in which there's no probabilities, where you have just discrete numbers doing Conway's game of life with just bits moving around. But floating point problems are like things that have floating point values, like this is a renderer which has some floating point value of how much light gets in there. It's not a yes or no light, it is the fraction of light that got in there. Perl and BZIP, you're just compressing bits and bytes in a very discrete mathy way. There's no floating point nature to Perl and BZIP in that sense. GCC and Go are the kind of thing. Go, you probably have some probabilities in there, but you don't necessarily have it depending on how you write your code. So they also measure system speed, specint, as well as the throughput. It's kind of a neat thing. So they actually have measures for both of those, and here's the website if you care more about them. Here are exactly all 12 and 17 that we have. This spec is a collaboration among not just the university folks, not just the industry folks, but everybody. You all get together and you revise these and you have these big committee meetings and you talk about what's the next suite. How do we update this suite for the current, you know, it's about time for an update, right? 2006 is about 4 years old. They're thinking about the revised versions right about now. So here are what we have on the integer side. I'll mostly focus on that. You can probably read this. Maybe you can't read this. Here's Perl, here's BZIP, here's GCC, here's some combinatoric-y thing, here's some Go searching, here's a gene sequence, here's some chess searching, here's a quantum computer simulation, which is pretty cool, here's video compression. It's funny that video compression ends up being on the integer side, not the floating point side, but maybe the way they do that thing is kind of clever in terms of leaving only integer size values. Here's an event simulation, here's a pathfinding guy, and here's some XML processing. So you ask yourself, well, that's interesting. That feels about right. That's what people use with computers, or not. Maybe this category might help you out here. Here's some ray tracing and some chemistry and some weather simulation. Here's speech recognition, fluid dynamics, biology, biochemistry. You know, the sciences are mostly all this side. Kind of cool. So let's talk about the demo. And I love this cartoon. I'm not sure how many of you can see it. I can try to zoom in using the magical Mac zoomy feature here. Let me see if that works. Our new chip is slower than our competitors' products. We'll claim we're the fastest. If anyone does benchmarks, we'll say they used old drivers. Whenever I talk to you, I feel like I should be wearing a wire. Since when is marketing a crime? So let me now show you this. I added this slide when I took this slide up. So I want to talk about some of the shady ways people have ever talked about performance competitions and demos. Okay? A, so you don't get taken. And B, if you're shady, do these things. All right, no, I'm joking. Number one, or number five, if you're doing a demo, this is the demo, right? Never let the user touch the demo. This is useful for you doing class demos of software. You make sure you drive it and don't let the professor or the guest walking up to your demo, touch it. You make sure that you only take the software through the paces that you've done, and if you click there, it crashes and smoke comes out. Just make sure you don't click there. No one else will click there either, because you drove that. Okay? Number four, only run the demo through a script. Make sure you have a script, make sure you've tested the demo, and make sure you just run it through your only set script. Only visit the path of the software or the demo or the whatever that is exactly what you've tested and verified works. You don't care what happens if you stray outside the boundary of that path. Number three, run it on a stock machine in which no expense was spared. If you are going to a trade show, you better literally go to Best Buy and say, here is all the money I have that I'll ever earn. Give me the fastest machine you could ever, ever, ever give me, because I'm doing a demo that the company you might be going to the big trade show that is the time where you show off your game at what's the game conference? E3 or CES? Whatever you're doing, you're showing a SIG graph. You're showing something off, and the impression you make on those reporters that sweep through and kind of visit your booth is the last impression you might get a chance to make. First impressions are critical, right? You only get one chance for a first impression. If you are running a game or a movie and it's dropping frames or it's staggering or the DVD isn't playing or the game is hanging up because it's page faulting, you are not going to make that sale. And that could be a $1 million, maybe even $1 billion decision for your point of view. If you're the new EA, the new game, and it looks bad because it's skipping frames on the demo, this is EA, you had better put all the money into the machine you run it on. So no expenses should be spared on the machine you run on. Pre-process all available data. This is actually a tip for you in general. Anytime you want to make a fast program, how much can you do in a pre-process step? In early games, who's an early gamer, where you would have these cinematics where I would have OpenGL doing a really blocky picture of something, and then I'd get to some cutscene where I'd then play a movie, which was gorgeous, and you'd have the lights and the water simulation, and it would look like Finding Nemo as you went from this stage to that stage, and all of a sudden, 4 pixels of my character moving around again, right? That was a pre-processed, pre-rendered cinematic that you put in between the action that you use, the real-time action in OpenGL. So therefore, to make your whole movie fast, this was pretty cool, you could pre-process every path the user would do, and it'd be all amazingly rendered Finding Nemo thing, right? But you can't do that because you want to let the user go anywhere, so therefore there's some trade-off between what you let the user do and what you pre-process. In general, pre-process as much as you can. If you know that there's only one way to move a path down the hallway, then make that a movie. And as they control it, you slow the movie up or slow the movie down, but the point is you have this amazingly rendered movie for that. And the last one, this is the key one, play a movie. So you'll say, what do you mean? So there is this may be apocryphal, but it's my favorite story of all time of a demo, where somebody years ago was showing off a flight simulator. And it was incredible. It had like 3 screens, and the person had this crazy joystick, and he was tilting his thing, and the flight was going, it was like, they'd never seen this kind of realism in this flight simulator. And one of the reporters looks around the corner and shows the cable of the joystick is not plugged in. And all they're doing is playing a pre-rendered movie in which they added all the number 2 effects as a movie. Are you with me now? So this is a person just leaning to the side, faking it as if he's, okay? That may be apocryphal, maybe not a real story, but if it has any resonance of truth, know that you should have at least a movie to back up. This is also not a bad idea in general. If your demo crashes, just play a movie. That movies always play. They always work. So just say, this is what it would look like if my demo hadn't crashed the day before. So have the movie in your back pocket, but don't show it without saying it's a movie, which is what this group did. All right. So I'm going to now talk about marketing. We're in the category of kind of the business school stuff of worrying about lies and economics and what you have to do. Let me talk about marketing and what Apple did some years ago to tout their processor. It was a G4 processor against, I think, a Pentium 4, Pentium 3. I forget what it was. You'll see it in 2 seconds. We're going to talk about, at the end, all the things that you thought were kind of marketing stretches of the truth. Okay, I'm not going to say call anybody a liar, but let's see how bad you can look the other processor look if you're talking about this. This is a great movie. All right, let's hit this.